everyone. Welcome back to another week's episode of Rising Giants with your hosts Max Thornton and Dominic Klusik. Today on the show, we're venturing into Thailand and we have Harpreem Dua on the podcast. He is a serial entrepreneur, having co-founded a long list of startups, including Fluffy, Pet Loft, What's New Thailand, Arami Moxie, Frank, and his most recent startup, Easy Digital. Easy Digital is at the forefront of the InsurTech revolution, offering a state-of-the-art SaaS platform designed to empower insurance companies and brokers of medium to large scale. They recently closed a funding round of $850,000 for their seed round. So we're really excited to talk with Harpreem and dive into his overall entrepreneurial journey and what the future holds for Easy Digital. Thanks so much for tuning in to Rising Giants. Harpreem, welcome to Rising Giants today. It's great to have you on the show. We'd like to start by just talking about some of the defining moments in your early years that set the foundation for you becoming a founder.
Okay, great. You know, first company I started was in 2012, straight out of my MBA program. And that was almost by chance. You know, I wanted to get into the startup world. So I started joining these programs called Startup Weekends. They were really big back then. And this was like probably the second startup weekend in Thailand ever. Went in without knowing anybody, without ever speaking to anyone there before, not knowing anyone in the industry at all. Met a bunch of random people at an icebreaker event that they had before that. Just got together with them and say, hey, let's start something together. You know, you're good at this. You're good at this. We need to make a team for this program we're in anyways. Would you like to be in our team? I'm like, okay, great. We pitched, came second place at the event. And 2 weeks later, one of the judges said, we actually really liked your idea at the event. Would you like to work on it together? I'll give you $50,000 for 50% of the company. And you have to understand the concept and mindset was like, we spent 3 days working on a PowerPoint presentation for a startup weekend event. I've never met these people in my life before. And it was just, you know, based on something that really happened really, really quickly off the, you know, just by chance. When we got offered $50,000 for 50% by a reputable VC, by the way, back then in Southeast Asia, Arden Capital, and they had founded companies like Ensogo. They had founded companies like AdMax and exited a couple of companies before as well. So these guys had a track record. I knew of the companies that they had founded. And when they offered that money to me, for me, it was like, great, I'll take it. And that's how my entrepreneurial journey really, really began. And from there, it just kept rolling and snowballing into where I am now. Yeah.
Great. And if maybe for the audience, so Dom and I, we're also a little bit new to like the Thailand startup ecosystem. So it'd be great if you could just set the framing for like what it was like being a startup founder, you know, 10 plus years ago in Thailand, and how has it shifted as the years have gone on?
10 plus years ago, you could literally count the number of founders there were in the industry. I mean, when I say industry, I mean the startup industry. Forget about any specific e-commerce or insurtech or fintech. No, none of that existed. It was just startups, and the people who were doing startups could fit in a small room, and everyone was there at that startup weekend, so to speak. And all of these guys were very supportive of each other, very helpful of each other. Any young person who had an idea or any friend or colleague all wanted to, you know, had to get into this sort of micro society, so to speak, in order to make it somewhere. VCs were non-existent. Singaporean VCs never even bothered looking at Thailand at that time. Thai CVCs didn't exist. The only VCs that were really here in Thailand at that time were, I would call them, more incubators than VCs. You had a lot of foreign companies setting up startups and setting up businesses in Thailand as the base because resources were cheap. So these are all, you know, German, Dutch, American, Italian guys coming into Thailand, setting up businesses here and running them, but not really as a startup as well. A lot of them just ran it as SMEs and sort of got labeled as a startup later on. So it was a wild west. Regulations were non-existent for a lot of technology-based companies. No tax benefits, no visa waivers. It was a wild west. That's the context of how I started. Early days, I think there were just two or three companies that were really big in Southeast Asia, in Thailand at that time. That would be the Rocket Internet Group. They were doing Lazada. They were doing Easy Taxi, and they were doing everything that they were already, you know, companies were already doing in the US, and they were just copying that model in Southeast Asia. Uber was still around back then in Southeast Asia as well. Grab didn't exist yet when I started, which is, you know, it's mind-boggling to think how far they've come in such a short period of time.
Right. And what about kind of comparing that to the current day? Like, what would you say it is? What is it like being a founder in Bangkok today?
Now, I would say it, you know, first of all, given the, you know, just everything the way it is right now, people are a lot more aware, people understanding of what a startup is and what it entails, how much investment it takes to make it and to grow it and scale it. There's been success stories. There's been a lot of bust as well. A lot of corporations that are family owned or family run, some of the largest corporations in the country have set up their own CVCs or venture arms to support these kind of companies as well, either for their own strategic purposes or just for, you know, helping foster the ecosystem. VCs are also looking a lot more in the country. You have a lot more people who've essentially localized, even though they're foreigners, they've lived here long enough to just sort of blend in with the culture and view themselves as Thai now, and they're starting a lot more companies as well. The younger generations have also looked at it as an actual career path as opposed to something that was a risk before. You know, back then, your goal when you came out of university was to get a job at a reputable company and just stay there till you retire. Not anymore. Now, it's actually a very common thing to go join a startup and work for a startup, actually use it as a stepping stone to scale and grow very, very quickly. And a lot of young entrepreneurs from college and universities are starting to go down that path as well. In fact, universities are also a lot more supportive of this, bringing in entrepreneurs as guest lecturers, bringing in companies that have exited to speak about the opportunities in the startup ecosystem instead of just going down the regular career path. I think this is actually what triggered a lot of CVCs to set up their own VC arm and CVC arm, because they're able to grab up a lot of these entrepreneurs very, very early and very, very quickly to join their companies under the guise of a VC, as opposed to, you know, come get a job with us.
Right. And what would you say is the main difference between, because I think for probably a lot of our listeners, they don't probably fully understand what like corporate venture capital is versus like a normal traditional startup investor that would be like just a normal VC. What would you say the main difference is working with them versus working with a VC?
Yeah. So, you know, VC is, essentially, the structure of it is very simple, right? You get money from private equity, you get money from limited partners, you get money from, you know, friends and families. You pool all the money together and you start investing that into startups with hopes for higher returns than you can get in the regular market. So, you know, VCs tend to expect, you know, 5 to 10x on their capital within a certain number of time frame compared to the market return rate. CVCs, on the other hand, are corporates that are already very profitable. They have a lot of money already. They already have existing businesses. And what they would try to do is set up a side arm, essentially, you know, allocate a pool of money to invest in startups or to invest in new ideas, most of the time for strategic purposes to help them with their core businesses. So you have a lot of banks doing that. You've got a lot of retail companies doing that, manufacturing, whatever. It doesn't matter what the industry they're in. And those are the CVCs that are actually really trying to set up. And most of the purpose is, again, like for strategically trying to grow their own businesses. You know, there's a lot of, it could cause conflict as well, because most of the time CVCs, they're not really expecting a return on their investment. They want to learn more about new technologies to fast track the way their companies grow. You know, it sort of happens with scale, right? The bigger you are, the slower you move, just by design, because you have more layers to go through and you have more just internal politics as well, right? To be very straight about it. CVCs generally sit on a silo and they work, you know, reporting straight to the management level of the corporations, and they're able to experiment a lot more. So a lot of corporates set up these CVCs as side arms, standalone, very nimble, small teams to be able to make quick decisions, all in the purpose of helping the mothership understand new technologies and new opportunities better.
Mm. Yeah, we are literally just in that like first innings in Cambodia on CVCs starting to like play a role, but it's only a handful as of now.
Yeah. You know, it's a risk as well, taking money from a CVC. It sounds great because a lot of the time, like, You get offered not just the money, you get offered a working space within the corporation as well. You'll get offered resources. You know, you're talking about HR, finance, marketing, whatever centralized resources they have. You also get offered guidance and potentially even access to the pool of customers that a lot of these corporations have if you're part of their CVCs. But the flip side of it is always that because their incentives are not to build to, incentives are not monetary, it's strategic. They most likely want a board seat, or they'll take quite favorable terms for them under the guise of like, we are a publicly listed company, we need to have these checks and balances in place. And it makes it very difficult for a lot of entrepreneurs to wiggle around further rounds of fundraising or even potential exits if they're not negotiated properly in the beginning. So it's just something to be aware of when working with CVCs.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point too, thinking about it, because especially the flex on resources that are available, even on say the developer side for tech too, a lot of businesses can see that as a very high value for them to accelerate the growth of their tech product, for example. So we, as Max had said, that we are in the early stages of that in Cambodia. So it's good to have a framework around that, especially as it's more mature in Thailand. And kind of going back to your journey, and I guess we could say serial entrepreneurship more or less, but you've co-founded quite a few companies during your career so far, and it'd be great to get a brief overview of each of them leading up to where you are today with Easy.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, going back to the first company, it was an e-commerce company back in 2012. You know, we got funded by Arden Capital, $50,000 for 50% of the company. That money went away really, really quickly. Again, it was the first time I started a company. You don't really realize how fast $50,000 can go out the window, hiring a couple of developers, you know, hiring a marketing team, a BD team, 3 months worth of salaries and it's already gone. So, you know, I got diluted down very, very quickly, to say the least, but it was a great learning experience for me because I was learning from one of the top incubators in Asia, in Southeast Asia at the time, Arden Capital, and they had started companies like Insogo, AtMax, A-Commerce, and a few other, you know, notable ones as well. Delivery was one of their incubated companies as well. So it was a learning opportunity for me, let's just put it that way. We scaled that company fairly quickly as I was a co-founder and the CEO of the country, Thailand. We merged with a couple of companies. We expanded from pet products to baby products to health vitamins and supplements. Eventually, that company became called Orami. We merged with a company in Indonesia called Bilna, raised almost $20 million in funding, and it was valued at $60, $70 million at one point. It was one of the largest fundraising in Southeast Asia at that time, actually, in 2016, by which point, you know, we'd had almost 10 chefs in the kitchen, let's just put it that way, through all the mergers and acquisitions that we had done, plus the board of directors, plus other management that we got on board. And the company was moving in a direction that was more of a general consensus than under the vision of a single leader. And it's not always a good thing when you go down that route. General consensus is not always the best, especially when you have many, many strong heads trying to fight for the loudest voice. So by that time, I said, you know what? I don't think this is the right place for me to be anymore. I've done as much as I can here. I've learned as much as I can. I'm just going to go out and do this on my own. So I left Orami and I went to start Frank. And Frank was still e-commerce, but I just wanted to sell a different category of products that didn't have anything to do with my previous company. So I was like, okay, I don't want to touch retail. I don't want to touch physical goods even. Let's look at financial products or some other category of products that I could sell online that I'd have to deal with inventory, warehousing, and logistics. And insurance, you know, just by chance, with someone who said, hey, have you looked at insurance before? You know, it's a massive market. People are starting to look at it and it's completely underserved online. Everyone is just still buying through agents and brokers. There's literally nothing you can do online for insurance. I said, okay, let's take a look at it. And it turned out to be great. And by going down that direction, we were able to get our seed funding from, you know, Pacific Century Group and NOAA founders out of Hong Kong. And we started Frank, scaled it very, very quickly. Within 4 years, we were doing almost $15 million of sales in a year just in Thailand alone. We had our offices in Hong Kong, in Taiwan. So we were starting to scale, you know, regionally as well. And 2020 came about and we got an exit opportunity to Bolttech, which at that time was just, side arm of F2BD, the insurance company. It wasn't even called Boltec yet. And they said, look, we want to acquire you at 100% because Pacific Century Group actually owns F2BD as well. So there was already that connection there. And they said, you know, F2BD should buy you guys out. We wanted to do something in the digital space. And we said, okay, let's do it. So we exited a Boltec, and it was great for the first year. We scaled very, very quickly under their branding as well. And by the second year, the environment came a little bit more corporate. And I said, okay, let's, it's past the golden handcuff period as well, which is also another trigger point for me. Golden handcuffs are, when you have to stay in to lock in your equity with the new company as well as get your full exit and everything else like that. So I was like, okay, it's a good opportunity to leave 2 years down the road. Let's go back to my entrepreneurial roots and start Easy Digital. And even Easy Digital started off by chance, because when I left Boltec, as I was telling you guys earlier, I was consulting for a couple of companies. They wanted to hire me full time. I said, no, I don't want to get hired. I don't want to do a job. Hire me as a consultant and I'll start, just presenting you some value first before I say yes to any potential job offers. So I had 4 or 5 consulting contracts at the time, started seeing a very common trend of what problems and what pain points they all were having, and decided to go build the product to solve those pain points myself. And this is where we are now.
It's so funny, like listening to you talk about your journey and each of the steps of getting together with a co-founder, getting product market fit, scaling, moving on to an exit, and then just rinse and repeat. When you talk about it, it sounds so natural. And it's like really refreshing to hear that. It's like, wow. Just sitting here being able to listen to that, that really motivating. And I'm sure for a lot of other entrepreneurs too, it's a process that put in place. And, one of those pieces that I'm curious about is around co-founders and how you were able to find good people to start a company with.
It sounds easy and natural for sure, but especially when I'm, painting an overview, 30,000 feet picture, but realistically throughout the years, through every iteration, there was a lot of pain involved in the way. Like even, starting from the beginning in my first company, gave away 50% of my company for $50,000. Very quickly, I got diluted away as I needed more money to run the company. Within the first 6 months of running that company, Arden Capital actually wanted to let me go and just take the idea and actually say, I don't think you're suited to be a CEO of a company. You have no idea what you're doing. You don't have any experience at all. And they actually already fired me. So they gave me the notice already. They sat me down in the board meeting and told me that. And I said, literally tears down my eyes. I walked home that day and I was like, struggling very, very badly, very, very deeply. But took 24 hours. And the next day I went back to the office, which already was a shock to everyone. They're like, why are you doing it back in the office? We just told you, be on your garden leave for the next month, bye-bye. I said, you told me I don't have experience. What if I offered you this? What if I offered to work for you under your guidance, cut my salary in half, take all my equity and put it on hold, everything, and I'll work for you for 3 months under you to learn everything from you. And if I can do it, then you can reinstate everything else. If I can't, then you have nothing to lose. You just got an employee for half the price with no equity, with no equity anyways. Are you okay with that? They said, let me think about it. 2 days later, they called me. They're like, look, we've fired tons of people in our life. We've never had anyone come back with an approach like this before. We'll take the offer. And it worked. 4 or 5 months down the line, they reinstated me as CEO of the company, gave me all my equity back, gave me everything back. I learned everything internally. I learned from a mentor, essentially, Tom, who is the CEO of e-commerce right now. And yeah, he taught me what to do, what not to do. And I learned from him what was important and what I needed to focus on. So it's not always smooth. And even with Easy Digital, when I was doing consulting for a lot of the insurance companies, I already had an idea that I wanted to pitch to them, because I always knew I wanted to get back into building something and doing something on my own. Consulting was always a short-term, short-term cash flow solving problem. So my idea was to make every customer an agent without having to go through the licensing or requirements of getting a license by using a referral methodology. So if you technically get a customer to refer another customer, you could still get the same effects of an agent, almost like an MLM methodology. And it works in small scale, but I was starting to pitch to clients already, and I was already starting to build pitch decks, build material to go fundraising on that idea. Very quickly, I hit into roadblocks with legal teams of insurance companies starting to say, look, it works great in small scale. We get your model. There's nothing illegal about it, but it's gray. It's too gray for us to be comfortable with as a large scale insurance company, because the moment you get to a threshold of, like, you know, let's say getting 10,000 people recommending another 20,000 people to you on a monthly basis, the regulatory body is going to come knocking and saying, why aren't these guys licensed? We are paying them commission technically. And we can tell them we're paying them a marketing fee or whatever, but it's never going to sit right with them. So you need to figure out another way to make this work. We're not going to do this with you guys. So, you know, it's like, okay, great. That's not going to work. Let's pivot the, you know, pivot the product a little bit and, like, see what else would work instead. So it's smooth until the high level picture. Like, heck, like, if you zoom out far enough from Earth, the Earth looks smooth. You know what I mean? But when you're living down here, you see bumps and mountains and, you know, crevices and trenches all over the place. So everything looks smooth from a super high level.
Yeah, I love that. I love that idea of if you zoom out far enough from the Earth, everything looks smooth. And I also love the underlying idea that you're bet on yourself and consistently going from stage to stage, in despite of whether it's the challenges you face or the successes that you had. It's always that consistency of, you know, you're staying true to yourself. You're going to bet on yourself and you're going to learn no matter what. And that's really what we've learned are very important characteristics of strong founders too. And so just to fast forward to Easy Digital, it'd be great to just talk a little bit about, for the audience first, just a brief overview of what Easy Digital does, and then what the journey's been like so far since starting in 2022.
Yeah, so right now our model is, we're an agency management platform for insurance companies. So when I was trying to pitch these insurance guys essentially ways to earn more money by leveraging referral networks, MLM type trees, to get their customers to recommend other customers, you know, the management team and the CEOs of a lot of these companies thought it was a great idea. But every time after the conversation would end, I would see them revert back to solving traditional and really basic problems that they were having internally. And a lot of that circled around agency and brokerage management. It was their bread and butter. 60-70% of the insurance company sales come from agents and brokers, and a lot of them are still very manually being handled. And when you say manually handled, I'm talking about, you know, issuing quotations, understanding their requests on a coming on a daily basis, statement management, dashboarding, promotions and campaigns, media sharing, onboarding, training, commission calculations. All of these functionalities are being done by, you know, tens and hundreds of people within the insurance organization, where the majority of the resources are being spent and still being done very manually, in a manual way. So our goal right now at Easy Digital is to solve that problem by providing a platform and a solution for the insurance companies to use with the agents to not just manage the operations, but help improve agents' efficiency so they can increase their sales. And it's by no means anything new. If you look at large insurance companies like AIA, who built, you know, their Vitality platform and other platforms like their IMO platform, Interactive Mobile Office, for their agents to access a lot of these tools, those are large-scale companies at a global level who've had these technologies built in a regional center and shared across multiple countries where they can share the cost. They've spent tens of millions of dollars doing that. Unfortunately, most other insurance companies in the market don't actually have the budgets or the resources to build these kind of platforms, nor should they, because they're not technology builders. They're not going to go out and build their own CRM. They're not going to go out and build their own core systems even. What makes them think they can go out and build their own agency management systems to build, you know, to work in a cohesive way? It took AIA almost 10 years to do that, with tens of millions of dollars spent regionally to get to 3-4 platforms that the agents have to log in at the same time to use all the functionalities in a non-cohesive way, because everything is built, you know, bit by bit, piece by piece. So we're taking learnings from that, and we're building this into one cohesive platform, packaging it up as a SaaS and selling it to the insurance companies to use very, very quickly to help improve their agency sales. And, you know, doing this, it took time to get to this model. It took time to get to the product as well. But I sort of realized very, very quickly, it's like, I'm actually building a tool I wish the insurance companies had given me when I was an agent and broker selling products for them. At Frank and Boltec, we were selling, you know, 15, 20 different insurance companies' products, and we were handling a lot of these operations by building short-term solutions and fixes ourselves, because these solutions were not provided to us by them. And we were considered a technologically advanced broker. Again, most brokers are not technologically advanced. They don't have the resources to build their own platforms. Most agents don't have resources to even open a website of their own, forget about it, you know, anything else, or even spending any marketing dollars. So it's something that they definitely need, especially we cannot negate this channel, right? It is the largest channel and has been the largest channel historically. Even with the rise of direct-to-consumer and digitization, insurance agents and brokers still hold a majority of the bucket for any insurance companies around the world. You're talking about Europe, you're talking about Asia, you're talking about US, still the same story. And they're well more advanced than we are in Asia, still being sold to agents and brokers. So it's not a channel we can negate. So why bother ignoring it? Why not just make it a lot more efficient, make it a lot more user-friendly through a platform? That's the idea, and that's what we do at Easy Digital.
Yeah, thank you for that very detailed explanation. How many sort of companies like this would you say exist in Southeast Asia that you would be targeting to, you know, sell this digital solution to?
So far, what I've seen is most of the time when I go an RFP, a request for a proposal or a request for a quotation from an insurance company, but these kind of platforms, I tend to go up against Salesforce. I go up against custom build solutions where they already have the idea of what they want, and they sort of go out and find a developer outside to build these platforms. So those are like the two biggest competition, you could say, that I go up against. You know, it's a very difficult proposition for me to get explaining to a lot of the insurance companies as well, that you don't have to go out and build these solutions yourself. You can use a ready-built solution. It might not solve 100% of your problems. It'll solve about 89%, but that's already the majority of what you need solved in order to get working. If you're trying to solve 100%, you're not going to get up anywhere. And also, when you're using a digital solution, it's okay to change your processes along with the platform as well, as opposed to build platforms around existing manual processes. A lot of insurance companies tend to do that. They look at the current process that they have and they get a developer outside or a custom dev house to build solutions to streamline those processes without actually realizing those processes were built because they're manual in that certain way. When you're moving to a digital way, you don't have to follow those same steps. You can bypass a lot of those steps. You can change that completely around. And that's the struggle, to be very honest. Again, it's also B2B sales. That's another struggle as well. Even if they like the platform, even if they like the idea, the decision to implement a new platform for an insurance company takes a lot of time. We see deal cycles of almost 6 to 8 months. But luckily, the deal cycles are large. The deal volumes are large. So when we get a contract, it's like a 7-year-long contract, 8-year-long contract.
And how has the thinking around like the price point evolved through time? Like, what would be the kind of annual fee that an insurance company would be looking to pay for a solution like this? And are you gonna shift to some different models there, or is it gonna stay as sort of one specific price?
Well, I think it'll be crazy if I don't keep shifting, right? I'm still learning as well. I'm only 1 year into this journey, to be really, really realistic. That, you know, March 2023 was when I onboarded the CTO. Before that was just me and my co-founder managing outsourced developers ad hoc basis. We didn't even have an office. We were running, you know, working from home and just meeting at a coffee shop once or twice a week to run everything. So yeah, it's an ever-changing process. The way we charge right now is, though, we charge by functionality as opposed to by number of agents onboarded. So we want to make it as clean, as simple as possible, as flat fee as possible, so that they see the value in expanding this and rolling this out to as many agents as possible. And that's the way we plan to start. We don't plan to shift to by agents anytime soon. I want this to be in the hands of as many agents as possible and give more functionality and then charge more for the functionality given.
Great. And what does the roadmap look like for 2024? What are some of the goals, milestones that you want to achieve? And also in the context of your, you know, your recent fundraising round in 2023 that maybe you can touch on.
Yeah, it always has to go around the fundraise as well, right? We don't want to be one of those companies that keep raising funding and, you know, keep burning a lot of money as well. As tech platform, the way I look at it, you know, I want to be similar to what WhatsApp was, you know, 50 people employee company, and they were able to exit for multiple billions of dollars. That was like an ideal case for me. The way I look at it is as a tech platform provider, I need to focus on the core platform. I need to build up this platform as quickly and as robustly as possible, where it's scalable, where I can launch it in multiple countries, configurable for, you know, system integrators to work with as well. And that means I have to spend a lot of my time and resources building the dev team. Having said that, dev teams do cost a lot of money. But if you get the baseline of clients there in place, you can become profitable also very, very quickly, especially if you keep your baseline fairly lean. So our goal for this year actually is to make sure that we can reach near profitability towards the end of the year and be present in at least 2 countries within the end of this year. And that's already a big ask considering we started the company last year, but at least it'll prove to investors one thing, that one, where our platform and our company can be profitable very quickly. 2, we're a scalable platform where we can roll it out across multiple countries. And next year, our goal would actually be to venture beyond insurance and to showcase that this is an agency management platform. Theoretically, it can work for any business that has agents selling on the ground who needs the following functionalities, who needs the same types of feature set. Ignoring the product line, it should be the way it is. And that's what we're trying to aim to, you know, do in 2025 as well. So it really makes this company valuable, not just from the investor perspective, but also from an exit opportunity perspective, where a lot of SaaS companies or a lot of large scale, let's just say, service providers are looking to engage with multiple clients and multiple large scale clients in multiple industries would want to acquire a company like ours.
Yeah, 2 important points there. The first one, talking about investors, I feel like a lot of investors in this year, their primary focus is in the companies that we've invested in or our portfolio companies. Is there a path to profitability that we can see on that roadmap? And that's been a lot of under the microscope, at least from the startup that I work at as well, and just across a lot of industries. And I'm curious for the second point in expanding into new markets, what would you say is the biggest challenge when you do look to expand outside of Thailand, for example? Where would be the next market that is enticing to go in and penetrate, or you feel like is the best strategic move?
At this stage, you know, we're looking at Hong Kong. We have a potential client that we're speaking to there right now, and it's looking really good. So that is something that we're venturing with at the moment. We're looking at Indonesia as well as a potential opportunity. Again, a very agency-driven market and huge potential there with the number of insurance companies that they are present there. We're also speaking to companies in Dubai and the UK. So it is definitely, you know, I'm not picky about which countries I go to next. I'm going where the opportunity is, where the clients are going to be. I don't want this platform to be like, okay, I want to roll out in this country next. I want to roll out in that country next. So no, I'm trying to go with the insurance companies that I'm working with. So for example, in Thailand, we're working with Tokio Marine, and they've already said towards the end of the year, if our processes with them go well in Thailand, they're going to roll us out across 4 other countries in the region as well. And then that's what we'll be. So we roll out with the insurance companies that we work with.
And in scaling the business this next stage, do you feel like is some of the knowledge and experience that you think is most important in order to achieve this roadmap that you're looking to accomplish?
Product, by far. We're a product-led company, so the product has to be top-notch. We have to keep designing it. We have to keep innovating on it. You know, right now we're messing around with integrating artificial intelligence into the platform, you know, leveraging just for simple use cases, like, for example, a help desk or even like an FAQ where an agent can start asking information on how to use the platform or where the functionalities are or what is it present. Instead of asking an agent or asking an individual, they should be able to ask a, you know, chatbot that can be able to answer all these things. Now we're trying to integrate those chatbots into the databases. If an agent starts asking questions like, you know, what were my sales last month compared to this month? That data is available already. The chatbot can look up that data, provide context, understand the question in a human language and respond in a human language as well. So it sounds very simple, but these sort of changes and these sort of functionalities, it's mind-blowing for a lot of industry, to be very honest, because everyone talks about being able and wanting to do things, but implementing these things are not always easy. But we're in a unique position where if we build the platform properly and we connect to all the databases that we need to from the insurance companies, we add the AI layer on top without them having to do any additional work. We're running off the data that they've already provided to us, which could be, you know, agent data, sales data, policy data, or even their FAQs and product profiles and, you know, PDF files. Yeah, it's that speed to launch it. And then we get a new module out as an AI module. We go approach them and say, would you like this AI module? It's only going to cost you $2,000 a month. And now you'll be AI enabling all your agents. For them, $2,000 a month to enable AI for all their agents is a godsend. You know, no one else will be able to offer something like that to them. And if they had to go out and build it themselves, it would take a team of developers almost a year to understand everything to be able to build it. But that's what we're trying to do. So it's definitely going to be product led. And the second part is on the sales side. Once you have the product, somebody's got to go out and sell it. And that's where I come in. And I'm trying to like get more people to help me with that as well. Because right now, I'm pretty much the only sales guy in the company. It's my job to get as many clients in the top of the funnel as possible.
Yeah, it's funny. My follow-up to that was going to be, what is it like building a sales team or in anticipation of building a sales team? And, you know, what is it that you feel like would be a reasonable onboarding time to bring on, you know, a couple of, you know, whether it's a couple of outbound, you know, outbound AEs or something along those lines?
I think we're a little bit too early for a sales team right now, but we've already started thinking down that process. One thing that we have to do is actually adapt the product a little bit to be able to onboard a sales team properly. Given that right now we're targeting large sales B2B insurance companies, there's only a limited number of companies available, and a lot of them require, you know, relationships at the C level to be able to start presenting these products to the companies. But in order to make the product a little bit more digestible for smaller scale companies, like could potentially even be agents and brokers, we're trying to take modules that we've already built. Like, for example, the promotions and campaigns module, which allows an insurance companies to create campaigns. Like, for example, let's target this agency group and say, if you sell 10 policies within the next week as an agent, you will get, you know, extra 5% commission. And let's target another agency group with another campaign who are more experienced to sell, you know, if you sell this new policy that we just had, a new health insurance policy, sell 500, you know, 1,000 baht worth of these policies within the next month, you will get trip to, you know, Phuket or something like that. So we have that capability to run these sort of campaigns. We're trying to take that piece out as a standalone product because that can be applied to multiple industries and multiple product categories. So once we've been able to, you know, pull out this single standalone piece, then it would be a good sales product, a product for a sales team to start going out and selling to thousands of clients as opposed to the few hundred insurance companies that exist right now.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And also just going back on your previous point on leveraging AI, especially around chatbots. In our prior episode, we just had a guy named Mongkol on. He's a Cambodian founder, and he leverages chatbots actually for his own daily use, personal use, just to be able to help him with whatever it is that he needs information on as quickly as possible. So yeah, that's very interesting to hear that theme continue to keep coming up.
Yeah. No, we come up with a use case first, and then we try to find what's the best tool available to help with that use case, right? In this case, it just happens to be AI. So, you know, with internal, like for example, internal onboarding, we actually have an internal chatbot that we use at Easy Digital here, where any new staff that joins or even existing staff wants to know anything about the company, wants to know about me, about the co-founders, about the, you know, what new media that we release, what our strategy, direction, all these things. Instead of keeping it in a file where they have to read, you know, 20 pages to understand all this stuff, it's all in the chatbot and they can ask it and they'll get the answer in that sort of sense and way. And I keep updating it essentially with new information that we write about ourselves, we have about ourselves, and it keeps learning based on what we're training it. So it's a use case, and then we apply chatbot to it. Same thing with the agency platform. We have a use case. We want agents to understand the platform. We want them to have access to all their information in a simple way, where some people might be more comfortable by just asking as opposed to by searching for it.
And just pulling everything back together with, you know, we discussed the journey of Easy Digital, some of the unique value props of your business, some of the competitors that you're going up against. as well as a lot of the pieces that go into building the great product, your great product. One thing that would be really interesting, and I'm sure a lot of entrepreneurs would love to hear, is how does it that you attract investors? Even if it's inbound or outbound, it's always something that comes up in our discussions where, you know, when you do decide to raise capital, is it the right time to raise capital? Are you just raising just to raise? I feel like there's a lot of gray area around that. So I'm curious to hear your perspective on, you know, maybe what it like, you know, how do you attract a great investor and when would be the best time to do that?
You know, when I started EG Digital first, as soon as I knew that it was going to be a product-led company where I needed to invest a lot of money and time into building a product, I started looking for a fundraising right away. I was funding it first. I started had to show traction. I showed that we already had the client on hand and with the MVP. And that's when I went fundraising. So I always try to go fundraising from a position of strength, meaning we were able to run our own capital. We were able to be profitable with the, you know, money that we had. Without the fundraising, we would still be able to survive. It'd just be a lot slower. And that was a story that I went in with as well. And it was not my first time speaking to investors, and also of having exited a company before and getting people on board who had exited companies before to be part of our team, that was already very helpful in reducing the risk for a lot of investors. At the end of the day, these guys are money managers, right? They're literally managing monies of their LPs to make as much return as possible. You know, my background, I have a financial background, so I get it from their perspective, and that's their job, and that's okay. So you have to reduce the risk for them as much as possible. And what are the kind of risks that they're going to have? Are the founders worthy? Is the idea tested? Is their product market fit? Can the company be profitable? Would there be an exit opportunity? These are just really basic questions that they're going to have. So you make sure you have a deck built out. You have a data room. You have all the information on there that they're going to need to make sure that you know what you're doing. You know how to run your, you know, your shit properly. And you have everything laid out in a clean, transparent, simple way for them to understand. By doing it that way, I didn't even have to, you know, I probably reached out to only two or three VCs on my own. The rest were all recommendation that they passed around. So because some VCs reach out to you, they talk to you, and they're like, look, we like your idea. You did a little bit too early. It's not within your mandate, but I know somebody else who's looking for something like this. And that's the best kind of introduction you can get into a VC. I was rusty in pitching, let me put it that way, because with Frank, I had, you know, it was in 2016 that I was pitching for investment. And after that, I hadn't really had to do anything. So it's been almost like 5 years before I had to go pitching again. So it took me some time to get that right as well. So I would say like the first 20 or so VCs that I spoke to were just brushing up on my, you know, pitching capabilities and understanding what they needed and getting back into that mindset. But after that, it was sort of like, you know, it just went right back at it very naturally. And we started getting a lot more conversions. In fact, I think totally we spoke to about 40 VCs and we were able to close 7 of them for our seed funding round.
Wow. That's a very high conversion rate. It's normally like, you know, 1 in 50, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I think to some extent, the attitude also helped. The attitude of like, look, this is, it's my business. I'm running it. I have money coming in from consulting contracts. We have a team. We already hired. We're already building it. We already know these consulting contracts are going to convert into customers. One of them has already started paying us for it. This is our revenue. We're profitable. You don't want to invest? You don't have to. It's okay. We're still going to make it happen anyways. We're still going ahead and doing it. We don't need your money. But if you want to come along for a ride, it's going to definitely make the journey a lot faster. And I'll be able to hire a much better team to get it done in a more scalable way. And you can see the opportunity.
Great. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Just moving on to our last part of the podcast. This is where we talk a little bit about, like, you know, some of the interpersonal side. So one question we wanted to ask is, like, what are some of the habits that you have on a daily basis that kind of keep you motivated on your mission? Yeah.
to-do list. That's one big thing that I have that really, really helps me keep on track. Horrible memory. So I commit everything I have to my Google Calendar and my to-do list. As soon as I have something to do, I'll just type it in instantly because I know like 5 minutes later, I'm going to forget about it and think about something else. So if without that, I would be nowhere. to the extent where my wife had access to my calendar, so she will also actively put in things we have to do on the weekend if we have plans going somewhere or doing something for the kids. She'll literally have to send me a calendar invite, you know, pick up kids from school or this or that, and I 100% rely on that. So that's like a habit that I've really built for myself, knowing my, you know, knowing where my limitations are, yeah, and trying to circumvent that. That's one. The other thing is I try to still stay very healthy. I don't want my health to ever get affected by whatever I'm doing. So, you know, I still go to, you know, I still play football, I still play basketball, I go to the gym, I run, these sort of things. And these activities just keep, you know, my mind healthy and my body healthy as well. It's, you don't want to get burnt out. I've been an entrepreneur long enough to see a lot of people just get extremely burnt out very, very quickly because they're working whatever, 120 hour weeks, which is ridiculous. You don't need to do that, right? You just work a little bit smarter and delegate the task away to a few other people that you can trust to be able to get there. You can't do this alone. This journey is not an alone journey. Even if you were the smartest guy in the world, if you had to make all the decisions yourself on a daily basis, you'd get, you know, decision fatigue. It'd make no sense. And by the end of the week, every decision you'd make would be a questionable one because you've made so many. It just... law of probability, you're bound to get like a certain percentage of them wrong.
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, those are a thing. I think the last thing I would say is probably as well, making sure I have a very balanced life with my, you know, wife and kids as well. So I always try to carve out time for them. So I drop my kids to school every day in the morning before I get into work. And then when I get home and like, you know, 5:36, I make sure I spend some time with them, put them to bed. And then if I have to go back to work, then I'll go back to work at home at that time.
And are there any particular like mentors, books, podcasts that you listen to that that really kind of stick with you through time?
So stay very relevant on, you know, current events of the world. So every morning I listen to, you know, world news podcasts for at least like an hour a day on the way going to work and on the way coming back. That's something that just, I find it very relevant. Also, you know, when you're speaking to a lot of people, you'd be surprised how many conversations get started by understanding what's happening around the world. And it just generally gives you a lot more awareness of, you know, where the waves or tides are shifting, as well as opportunities that they are, as well as what's going on that you should avoid. That's definitely one thing. I'm not much of a reader myself. I don't read a lot of books, and I think that's a fault that I should probably work on. I read a lot of articles. That's something I do, and I'm a very visual learner, so I watch a lot of YouTube, especially videos around just learning stuff that you don't normally know. It could be anything, right? I just like to keep myself learning about random things. And, you know, it could be woodworking, you know, working on cars, you know, just why, like recently I was reading about, the YouTube video about why electric car ownership is not as rosy as it sounds, or like why car mechanics are becoming more expensive around the world, or even the latest news about Hertz and why they're selling their fleet of Tesla EVs, you know, and dumping it and going back to regular petrol vehicles and stuff. So, you know, there's plenty of ways to get a lot of information. I try to get as much information in my head as possible. That's generally what I do.
Yeah, just a quick...
Great, yeah.
Sorry, no, I was just going to say a quick comment there, Max, for talking about the Tesla. I don't know if you saw the recent video of, I think it was like a flooding somewhere in California or San Diego specifically, and it has the Tesla just like powering through like probably 6 feet of water, and just so impressed. I'm like, wow, this thing is actually a beast.
it's all sealed components, right? Like everything is weather sealed, so it can still run. Doesn't mean it's gonna last very long though, because corrosion will happen, and that's not gonna, you know, it might not show its effect right now. Unlike combustion engine, the water gets into intake and screws up your pistons right away, but it'll show up in an EV in a couple of weeks.
As we come out to closing out the podcast, Harpreet, we really want to thank you so much for coming on to the show. Our final question that we do like to ask each of our guests, though, is what is the greatest piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Wow, that's it's sort of like an analogy, like, you know, you're doing in life, you're sort of juggling, you know, you're juggling many things at the same time, right? You've got family, you've got work, you've got your health, right? A couple of those things when you're juggling, once you lose it, is going to be very difficult to get back. And that could be your family and your health. But work, regardless of how important it is and how much effort and how much time you put, is where I spend most of my time. it's something that's always going to bounce back. Like if this idea doesn't work, I can come up with another idea. I can go get a job. I can find another way to make the means. But family and health, those are things that are not going to always bounce back. And it's something that I think a lot of entrepreneurs in the past have always advocated working, sleeping in the office, doing everything you can to make sure the idea works, hustle, ignore everything else, put on blinders and just get that done sort of mentality. And I don't actually agree with that. I very much disagree with that. I'm not saying don't work hard, work smart, delegate your work, figure out the best path to get to your goal, write down what you need to achieve, write down what you need to do to achieve those things, make every single task, a subtask of a subtask so that you can eventually get to the highest goal that you want to get to. But do not ignore the health and family side of what you're doing, because that's what you're doing it for. And if you forget or lose sight of what you're doing things for, then eventually when you get there, you're going to be like, what did I lose or what did I think? And somebody said this to me before and it really stuck with me was, if you miss your wife's birthday or your kid's birthday or a big event at home, you're always going to remember you missed that event, but you never, ever remember why you missed that event. Doesn't matter how big the other thing was, you're always going to remember that. And that tells you something. That says something, right? Like even back in college or, back in those days where you're like, oh, I'm going to skip this party. I'm going to skip this trip with my friends because I'm going to go study for this because it's really, really important. I have never remembered what I was studying for or what the book or what that exam was, never. But till today, I'll be like, damn, I wish I went to that party, or damn, I wish I went on that trip. That looked like a memorable trip. Like that's something I never, ever forget. And it is the way it is, right? That's just life for you. Now, I don't know whether this is just the grass is greener on the other side thing talking, but it just sort of comes with age, it comes with wisdom. And it just, that's some advice that I've really, really taken to heart. Another one that I have to share is, get a mentor. And it doesn't have to be one person. It could be two or three people, professionally speaking, that you can trust, that you can speak to, that you can share and bounce ideas off. They are extremely, extremely useful. And I'm lucky enough to have, one of my mentors or one of the people that I admire to be so closely working to me. John, my CTO, his brother is actually Tom, one of the founders of Ardent Capital and e-commerce. And John is also one of the founders of Ardent Capital and e-commerce, and he's my CTO right now. So having them close by like this and being a part of the team means if I'm doing something wrong, they'll call bullshit on it right away. And they'll not be afraid to tell me why, as opposed to working with team members who are always skirting around the problem and being a little bit more diplomatic. And it's just a waste of time. I'd rather, just have these straightforward people in my life and being there telling me you're doing the wrong thing, you're doing the right thing. In my opinion, you should work on this, you need to fix this. This is how I think, this is what I've experienced before, and this is what's going to happen if you go down this path. At least they make you aware of the problems instead of the ones that just keep silent.
Yeah, and it's the family time is super important. I understand very well, making sure to have that balance too. That's something that we'll definitely take away from the conversation is you'll never remember what it is that you miss, but you'll always remember what it is that you missed at home. So that's a really good takeaway. But in any case, thank you so much for joining us on the show today for Rising Giants. It's, I believe, our first Thai founder that we've had on the show. Max can correct me if I'm wrong. So we are, our founder from Thailand, we are very excited to be able to see how Easy Digital continues to grow over the next year and look forward to keeping in touch.
Well, thanks for having me. It was a really fun conversation, guys. I really enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.